Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Scientists created low-fat pigs by editing their genes with CRISPR, by Alice Park. Raising pigs for food is a tricky business, mostly because of their fat, the part that makes bacon so tasty. You can't plump them up too much because overly fat pigs are more expensive to raise. Since they're not as efficient at burning body fat, they require more energy in the form of heated pens and barns to keep them warm. Yet too skinny pigs aren't able to regulate their body temperature properly and tend to die when temperatures drop. Farmers have to find a way to keep their pigs healthy but plump enough to produce meat. Now, in a paper published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers in China report that they have created healthy pigs with much less body fat. Using the gene editing tool CRISPR, which can precisely edit DNA, the scientists inserted a gene that helps pigs to burn fat to stay warm. Turns out that pigs don't have this gene, which other mammals, including mice and rats, use to regulate their body temperature. The Chinese research team inserted a mouse version of the gene into embryonic pig cells, then coaxed those cells to generate more than 2,000 pig embryo clones that were genetically identical to each other. Female pig surrogates gestated the embryos, and 12 male piglets were born with the new gene. The genetically modified pigs contained about 24% less body fat than pigs without the gene. The animals were bred for their meat, but it's not yet clear whether the genetic change affected the taste or quality of the pork they produced. Autopsy of the animals at 6 months showed their organs and tissues seemed to be normal. If the results are replicated, the pigs may represent new agricultural potential. Leaner pigs that don't get cold, don't cost as much to raise, and make potentially healthier, lower-fat bacon. But don't expect these pigs to fly in the U.S. anytime soon. Because they're genetically modified, the Food and Drug Administration would have to approve them after being reassured that the meat they produce is safe to eat. The safety of CRISPR hasn't been completely proven yet either. Some researchers point out that as precise as CRISPR is, it's still not perfect. There's always a chance that CRISPR could introduce some other unintended changes in the DNA that might have negative consequences. For now, however, the pigs are proof that it's possible to make lower-fat pork. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake will not seek re-election, saying, "I will not be complicit." By Alana Abramson. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake said Tuesday he will not seek re-election and gave an extraordinary rebuke on the Senate floor to President Donald Trump and the rightward shift of the Republican Party. "These forces," Flake told his colleagues, "have made his path to the Senate nomination increasingly narrow as a conservative standard bearer, and he would rather step aside than remain complicit, both with the evolving viewpoints and the calls for unequivocal support of President Trump. I have decided that I will be better able to represent the people of Arizona and to better serve my country and my conscience by freeing myself of the political consideration that consumed far too much bandwidth and would cause me to compromise far too many principles," he said on the Senate floor, adding that he would conclude his service in the Senate in January of 2019. Flake is the second senator to announce his retirement this cycle. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, with whom Trump has been openly feuding, announced in September he would not seek re-election. Corker, who supported Trump during the 2016 election, said on Tuesday that he would not make that same decision again if given a do-over, that the president was a poor role model for the country's children, and that he has, quote, "great difficulty with the truth." Flake's remarks seemed as much a call to action for his colleagues to rebuke the president and his rhetoric as they were an announcement of his future plans. Although he never explicitly mentioned Trump by name, he cited how personal attacks, the threats against principles, freedoms, and institutions, the flagrant disregard for truth or decency are emanating from the executive branch of government, and that the chamber has an obligation to speak up because it is threatening democracy. If we simply become inured to this condition, thinking that this is just politics as usual, then heaven help us, he said. When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are we going to say? I rise today to say, enough. We must dedicate ourselves to making sure that the anomalous never becomes normal. His past criticism of President Trump, he explained, has stemmed from that obligation. I am aware that a segment of my party believes that anything short of complete and unquestioning loyalty to a president who belongs to my party is unacceptable and suspect, he said. If I have been critical, it is not because I relish criticizing the behavior of the President of the United States. If I have been critical, it is because I believe that it is my obligation to do so as a matter of duty and conscience. Before taking the Senate floor, Flake had conveyed these sentiments in an interview with the Arizona Republic. There may not be a place for a Republican like me in the current Republican climate or the current Republican Party. He also told the Republic that the primary voters he would have needed to win over are concerned about candidates' allegiance with Trump, and he was unwilling to falsely throw unequivocal support behind the president. The open seat provides another opportunity for the Democrats to regain a majority in the Senate, but could also end up getting filled by a more right-wing and Trump-oriented member of the Republican Party. The senator was facing a primary challenge from Kelly Ward, a former state senator who had unsuccessfully challenged Senator John McCain in 2016. Ward was recently endorsed by former White House strategist Steve Bannon, who has vowed a self-declared war on the Republican establishment. Shortly after Flake finished his speech, Ward wrote on Twitter that his decision was a win for Arizona's constituents. They deserve a strong conservative in the Senate who supports POTUS and the America First agenda. Our campaign proudly offers an optimistic path forward for Arizona and America. #MAGA, she wrote. Top U.S. general gives few answers on U.S. soldiers killed in Niger. From the Associated Press in Washington. The U.S. Special Forces unit ambushed by Islamic militants in Niger didn't call for help until an hour into their first contact with the enemy, the top U.S. general said Monday as he tried to clear up some of the murky details of the assault that killed four American troops and has triggered a nasty political brawl. Marine General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters that the American people and the fallen soldiers' families deserve answers about the deadly ambush in the West African nation. But he said he still lacks many of the details about how the attack unfolded, and he asked for patience as the military investigation continues. Dunford's description of the incident, however, underscored how long the mid-morning attack dragged on and that it was many hours before the wounded and killed were evacuated. He said that within minutes after the unit called for assistance, a U.S. drone was moved into position overhead, providing surveillance and full-motion video. He declined to say if it was armed, but said it did not fire. Another hour went by before French fighter jets arrived, but the wounded weren't taken out until later in the afternoon when French helicopters arrived along with additional Niger troops. The bodies of the three Green Berets who were killed were evacuated that evening, he said. I make no judgment as to how long it took them to ask for support, Dunford said. I don't know that they thought they needed support prior to that time. I don't know how this attack unfolded. I don't know what their initial assessment was of what they were confronted with. A battle-hardened commander, Dunford recalled situations when you're confronted with enemy contact. Your initial assessment is you can deal with that contact with the resources that you have. He added that under the military's rules, U.S. forces only accompany Niger troops on missions in that area when the chances of enemy contact are unlikely. But he also agreed that it is an inherently dangerous area, and U.S. forces are there as part of a training and advising mission to help local Niger forces learn to deal with the various Al-Qaeda and IS-linked groups operating in the region. Dunford acknowledged that nearly 3 weeks after the attack, many questions remain.
They include whether the U.S. had adequate intelligence, equipment, and training. Did they have an accurate assessment of the threat in that area? How did they become separated in the fight? And why did it take so long to recover the body of Sergeant David Johnson, who was missing for 2 days before his body was found by Niger troops and turned over to the U.S.? He said the 12-member Army Special Forces unit accompanied 30 Nigerian forces on a reconnaissance mission to an area near the village of Tongo Tongo, about 85 kilometers north of the capital, on October 3rd. They ended up spending the night there, and when they were returning to their base the next morning, they encountered about 50 enemy fighters traveling by vehicle, carrying small arms and rocket-propelled grenade launchers. Dunford said the White House was notified by the Operations Center when it became clear that at least 3 U.S. forces had been killed, and more direct notifications were made when officials realized that Johnson was missing. When he received the call about Johnson, Dunford said he made a 20-second call to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and got immediate approval to bring the full weight of the U.S. government to bear in order to locate the missing soldier. Independent of the events surrounding the attack, Johnson's death and his family's ordeal have become a major political dispute. After Johnson's body was returned to the U.S., President Donald Trump credited himself with doing more to honor the dead and console families than any of his predecessors. Then Johnson's aunt said Trump showed disrespect to his family as he telephoned to extend condolences. In an extraordinary White House briefing, John Kelly, the former Marine general who is Trump's chief of staff, shot back at Trump's critics, and the president continued the criticism over the weekend. Members of Congress are also demanding answers. Last week, Senator John McCain, the Republican chairman of the Armed Services Committee, even threatened a subpoena to accelerate the flow of information from the administration. Asked about the congressional complaints, Dunford said that if lawmakers believe they aren't getting enough information, then I need to double my efforts to provide them with information. He said the military will try to wrap up its investigation into the incident as quickly as possible. The FBI is also investigating, but that probe likely focuses on counterterrorism and any information or intelligence related to threats to the U.S. Dunford defended the broader American mission in Niger. He said U.S. forces have been in the country intermittently for more than 2 decades. Currently, some 800 U.S. service members are supporting a French-led mission to defeat the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram in West Africa. We are back to conducting operations as normal, he said. Our intent is to continue operations there and continue to train, advise, assist our partners.
President Trump argued this murder case proved him right on immigration. Here's what it's like inside the courtroom. By Katie Steinmetz. Temperatures were hot in San Francisco on Tuesday as the trial of Jose Inez Garcia Zarate entered its second day. Inside the San Francisco Superior Court, people fanned themselves, and Judge Samuel Feng repeatedly invited attendees to take off their suit coats as the prosecution and defense tussled over the details of what happened on the evening that 32-year-old Kate Steinle was shot and killed. The murder case has become a flashpoint in national debates over illegal immigration because Garcia Zarate, a Mexican citizen who had been deported 5 times, was released by the local sheriff's department weeks before the shooting took place in 2015, despite a federal request to detain him. The sheriff at the time has cited San Francisco's so-called sanctuary policies as the reason he was discharged, and President Trump has invoked Steinle's name as evidence that border security must be tighter, immigration enforcement tougher. No one denies that Garcia Zarate, who was homeless at the time, handled the gun that killed Steinle as she walked along Pier 14 with her father. But while questions about the policies that help lead an undocumented immigrant to that spot surround the trial, they will not play a role in the courtroom. The issue at stake is what Garcia Zarate's intentions were. Did he discover a gun wrapped in rags under a bench and accidentally set it off, as his public defender has argued? Or did he shoot the firearm at a picturesque tourist location with an intent to kill, planning for the bullet to hit a human being? The answer will determine whether he is convicted of second-degree murder, facing up to 15 years in prison. Matt Gonzalez, his attorney, described the incident as a tragedy while speaking to reporters outside the courtroom on Tuesday. He also said it was an accident waiting to happen. Investigators found that the bullet that killed Steinle hit the ground 78 feet away from her before ricocheting into her back. Inside the courtroom, Deputy District Attorney Diana Garcia brought forth several witnesses who testified about seeing Garcia Zarate on the pier that evening, asking questions that might help reveal his state of mind as the family of Steinle sat stoically behind her for much of the day. One was Michelle Lowe, a tourist from the East Coast who spoke to the court through a Cantonese interpreter as Garcia Zarate listened to a Spanish translation through a headset. Lowe described a man who was dressed in black who was turning around in a swiveling chair on the pier before the shooting, laughing and grinning and looking at people who walked past. She testified he made her feel uncomfortable. Another witness, a third grade teacher named Maria Moreno who watched the scene unfold from the fifth floor of a hotel across the street, described hearing a loud bang and screams of horror before watching Garcia Zarate briskly walk away from the scene with a scowl on his face. Gonzalez quizzed her about whether that might have been a determined look rather than a scowl. She said she couldn't say. He seemed to spend most of the day working to identify discrepancies and subjectivity in various accounts, drilling into details like the difference between staring and looking. Speaking to reporters in the morning, Gonzalez also said that while his team's defense does not rest on issues of competence, it would be wrong to pretend that there aren't also mental state and mental health issues in play. As the day came to a close, the prosecution played a long video taken by crime scene investigators in the hours after Steinle was taken to the hospital. A police officer shot the video as he slowly walked along Pier 14, which juts out in front of the Bay Bridge near the Ferry Building. The sun is setting in bright purple and pinks. The scenery is beautiful, but the camera lingers longest on splashes of red blood that remained on the ground. No matter what happens in the case, such emotional images may find their way into debates over immigration policy in the future, even though there have been calls to leave her name out of the political arena out of respect for her family. Steinle's death has already inspired federal lawmakers to introduce an immigration bill that some call Kate's Law, which would increase penalties for deported individuals. That rhetoric will at least be absent over the next 7 weeks or so, as lawyers in San Francisco drill down into the details of Steinle's case rather than the big picture. Gonzalez said on Tuesday that he planned to use the video footage in future arguments about where Garcia Zarate was sitting and just how far that put him from the young woman. The defense of accident is really also what happened, he said.
Robert Redford. Scott Pruitt is hell-bent on dismantling EPA rules. By Robert Redford. 47 years ago, none other than President Richard Nixon established the Environmental Protection Agency, realizing clean air, clean water, and open spaces should once again be the birthright of every American. Since that hopeful launch of the EPA, both Republican and Democratic presidents have affirmed that environmental issues transcend politics. That's simple to understand, as the impacts of clean air, water, and climate change impact all Americans and everyone around the world. What we need to pay more attention to right now, before it's too late, is the reality that we've put someone in charge of protecting the environment who seems hell-bent on the opposite. Current EPA head Scott Pruitt is moving mountains of policy in the directions he favors, and those directions don't benefit you, or me, or our families. They only benefit the companies and industries that pollute and profit, and they will do whatever it takes to advance their agenda. Now you can add censorship to the list of new EPA techniques. Just this week, EPA scientists who were scheduled to present their research at a leading and respected conference in Rhode Island were told they were no longer allowed to even share their findings with colleagues. There is no democracy in darkness. My heart goes out to all who have suffered and are suffering each and every time I turn on the news. These changes to our environment and future are very real, with very real consequences we are experiencing every day. We simply cannot let Scott Pruitt's slash-and-burn attitude toward environmental protections continue. It's time to put renewed pressure where it's most needed, in challenging and shining light on what's taking place every day at the EPA. Here's how. Call your elected officials today and let them know you want a tough and science-led EPA with the strongest mandates for protecting our environment and our future. Let them know what you think of Scott Pruitt's leadership and ask them to support stronger oversight of the agency, stronger scrutiny of their decisions, and ethics investigations into any wrongdoing.
My voice is something special. Soprano He Hui, soprano Hei Wei blazes a trail for China's opera singers. It's just past 10 a.m., but even the eastern glare off Victoria Harbor can't uncover a smudge in Hui Hei's filigree eyeliner. The Chinese soprano commanded the chambers of Hong Kong's cultural center late last night as Aida. For singers, a three-hour marathon of the lungs and diaphragm, and yet she still greets you with a warm ciao, feathery, clip-bound tresses, and the diva's abhorrence of pop music. La Tortora, she explains, brandishing her fists with a boom, boom, boom. She laughs, and you can hear the elasticity of her vocal cords, the suppleness of a slingshot ready to lob a high C into the dress circle at any moment. Opera powers Hei's orrery, so her time in Hong Kong, like every other city in which she performs, is fleeting. She'll depart tonight on a flight back to Verona, Italy, swap suitcases, and then glide in fabulous orbit to New York City, where she'll swap Giuseppe Verdi's heroine for Giacomo Puccini's Cho Cho San to open Madama Butterfly at the Metropolitan Opera on November 2nd. She loves New York, but also responds deeply to the Asian Manhattan, to Hong Kong's entrepôt culture and its mercantile mix of Orient and Occident. Hui Hei's operatic career is remarkable in its own right. Ever since landing second place in Placido Domingo's Operalia in 2000, she has performed in every leading theater in the world, from the Vienna Staatsoper to Paris's Opéra Bastille. Usually starring as Aida or Madama Butterfly, she has sung those roles over 150 times each. But she's not just a soprano. She's a soprano from China. In 2010, she was the first Chinese soprano to star in Aida at the Met, and in 2013, Tosca at La Scala in Milan. And while there certainly have been other successful Asian opera singers, she has been widely praised for her ability to have overcome the nuanced linguistic barriers of a historically Western art form and thrive in the international arena. With the talent and tenacity to transcend cultural differences, Hui Hei is a trailblazer and a harbinger of the rise of Western opera in the world's most populous nation. She's part of a new generation of opera singers from China who are very gifted, Peter Gelb, general manager of the Metropolitan, tells Time. At the same time, Hei's is deracinated voice. Ask her where home is, and the 45-year-old will immediately say Xi'an, China, followed by a but. There are the 19 years she has spent living and training in Verona, Italy. But then again, she only spends 2, maybe 3 months a year at her apartment there. It is little more than a home base between stints at the world's most prestigious opera houses. Perhaps the stage is her only true home. As Butterfly, I have something very soft, a big personality, she says of her connection to Cho Cho San. Also, as Aida, I feel this because Aida is a princess out of her country, and I think I am the Chinese out of China, and I feel this same way on how to feel about the country. Barriers to entry for opera are manifold, but race is not one of them, and these days race-based casting is a non-issue. Asian singers don't necessarily play Cho Cho San, the Japanese protagonist of Madama Butterfly, just as black singers don't necessarily play Aida, the Egyptian princess of African descent. While preconceptions of Asians having lighter voices still exist, Hei defines that with a voice that's proved to be well-suited for the heavy roles of Puccini. I like to think we are colorblind when we are casting, says Gelb, highlighting the Met's troupe of several minorities. We want the best of the best, whether you're from New York or Beijing. This notion is echoed by Hei. They accept me as an opera singer, not because I'm Chinese, she says. They accept me because my voice is something special. Linguistic obstacles remain firmly planted, however. All traditional Western operas are sung in some sort of European language, so you need to conquer the languages, you have to master them, says Warren Mock, acclaimed tenor and founder of Opera Hong Kong. When you see a non-European auditioning on the stage, first thing they criticize is your language, then your diction, then your voice. You have to work double. Nearly 2 decades of Italian training distinguishes Hei's career. After her math teacher discovered her voice in high school, A moment He describes as in fiamme, the fire of her life, she moved to Verona. Italians are notorious for booing singers off stage, but she mastered their language well enough to land the lead in Puccini's Tosca at the Teatro Regio di Parma in 2002. She's like an idol for younger singers, says Mock of aspiring Chinese vocalists. She made it. China has produced many great singers with voices kissed by God, explains Ken Smith, columnist for Opera China magazine and the Asian performing arts critic of the Financial Times. But historically, what they haven't excelled in is the repertory. It's sometimes painfully obvious that they don't conversationally speak the language they're singing or even understand the dramatic subtleties of what they're supposed to be doing. China's lack of exposure to essential operatic languages or stagecraft is a byproduct of the Cultural Revolution. Until China opened up in 1976, any influences that strayed from communist ideology were smothered out. Western opera in China was virtually non-existent. But now that's all changing. Hui Hye and her generation dovetail with China's reawakening to the art form. Retirees dominate the audience of operas in the West, but in China, where few were exposed to opera until the 70s and 80s, audiences consist of affluent 35 to 45-year-olds. Opera houses are opening up all over the country, with Western directors and singers frequently invited to put on shows. According to Opera China magazine's 2016 figures, there were 81 opera productions across China, 41 of which were Western. Since the 2008 opening of the National Center for Performing Acts in Beijing, NCPA, China's most prestigious opera house has put on 53 productions, 40 of which were Western, averaging about 6 annually. You have to feed the mouth first, then you think about culture, says Mock. That's exactly what's happening in China. Of course, after facing the idiomatic and cultural hurdles requires landing the most important, talent and endurance. Opera is more than just an art. It's a sport. Opera singers are vocal athletes, explains Gelb. They have to use their entire body to produce the sound that comes out of their mouths. There are no microphones in opera, so it takes enormous amounts of physical stamina and unwavering concentration to fill a theater with your voice for several hours at a time, not to mention the drama the roles entail. I think there are many people who are like how I was initially, not knowing the meaning of the opera or Italian, says He. In the future in China, I believe there will be more and more people who walk the path I've walked, standing on international stages. Despite what her passport stamps say, He's heart is in her birthplace. Her parents are getting older. Her father is 87 years old and her mother is 78, so she visits as often as she can. Just before her trip to Hong Kong, she spent 3 weeks in Xi'an with them. Otherwise, they FaceTime every day. She cooks spicy food often, and every time she sings Aida's O Patria Mia, she thinks of China. Xi Jinping becomes China's most powerful leader since Mao Zedong, by Charlie Campbell in Beijing. The first handshake was for Jiang Zemin, China's 91-year-old former leader, who sat immediately to Xi Jinping's left. Then Xi, newly reaffirmed as Chinese president for another 5 years, strode down the ranks of top cadres seated on stage at Beijing's Great Hall of the People, shaking hands and sharing congratulations on the culmination of the 19th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP. Though he paid respects to Jiang, who had to be steadied by two aides while standing for the closing March of the Volunteers national anthem, Tuesday's ceremony was all about Xi. Upon having his personal philosophy etched into the national constitution, as Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era, the 64-year-old now joins Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping in the pantheon of modern China's most powerful leaders. Our party shows strong, firm, and vibrant leadership. Our socialist system demonstrates great strength and vitality, Xi told delegates and journalists seated in the gaping Mao-era chamber. The Chinese people and Chinese nation embrace brilliant prospects. In the years since Mao founded the People's Republic of China in 1949, no other leader since the great helmsman himself has been honored by name in the Constitution while alive. Deng Xiaoping theory was appended only as posthumous honor to the architect of China's economic revival. But Xi has not only joined Mao on Mount Olympus, he does so at a time when China boasts the world's second biggest economy and is extending its influence across the globe. It was also, until recently, the world's top trader. It's the coronation of Emperor Xi, says Professor Nick Bisley, an Asia expert at Australia's La Trobe University. He is, without question, the paramount leader and one with a remarkably ambitious vision for China. That vision has domestic and foreign elements. Whereas previous Chinese leaders would smilingly play down the world's most populous nation as developing or poor, Xi unashamedly called China a great power or strong power 26 times in his opening speech last week. He has ramped up the construction and militarization of islands in the South China Sea and opened China's first overseas military base in Djibouti. His signature Belt and Road Initiative, repaving the ancient Silk Road through a trade and infrastructure network across Eurasia and Africa, was also added to the Constitution on Tuesday, indicating its central place in his thinking. In his opening address, Xi said his new era will be one that sees China moving closer to center stage. At home, Xi wants to lock in his anti-graft campaign, which he said Tuesday has cut like a blade through corruption and misconduct, and turn his attention to economic reform. In order for China to avoid the dreaded middle-income trap, he needs to trim the wings of its mammoth state-owned enterprises, which helped propel China's export-led growth over the past three decades, but risk becoming a millstone as the nation pursues the next stage of development. She's really been a bit of a fizzer in terms of economic reform so far, says Bisley. But by making himself the unrivaled center of power, he's got a better platform for making these other reforms stick. The purging of senior officials during Xi's first term demonstrated that he was not a leader to be crossed. Now that his personal dogma is enshrined in the nation's charter, challenging him could even be considered seditious. The true extent of his power will emerge Wednesday when the new Politburo Standing Committee, PSC, China's top executive body, is unveiled, and we see how many key allies have been retained and promoted. One name that won't be present is Wang Qishan, Xi's enforcer who headed his sweeping anti-corruption purge, who didn't make it onto the CCP's central committee. Aged 69, Wang is 1 year above the unofficial age limit for PSC members, but many believed a buoyant Xi would have broken with convention to keep his powerful ally by his side. It's a surprise for me, says Wu Qiang, an independent commentator based in Beijing and former professor of political science at Tsinghua University. It means there will be more uncertainties over the next 5 years. At present, no leader in the party could replace Wang. The key question that remains is whether any younger leaders are promoted to the PSC, as these, by implication, will be the cadres groomed to assume the top posts of president and premier at the 20th Congress in 2022. The most common candidates mentioned are Hu Chunhua, Zhang Qinghui, and Chen Minher. Though if none make the cut, then it will look like Xi is preparing to stay on for longer than the next 5 years. Xi is on the road to be China's most powerful leader, but he hasn't reached the peak, says Wu. Over the next 5 years, Xi will institutionalize his power in the party. In the end, he may get rid of the Politburo and become the real president of China.
Here's How Mothers Around the World React When Their Babies Cry, by Belinda Luscombe. Having a kid changes a mother's brains, and it's not just mother brain, the forgetful state new moms complain about. Research has shown that pregnancy changes the architecture of the brain for at least 2 years in areas that govern the understanding of the thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and intentions of others. Now, a new study published in the journal PNAS suggests that maternal brains around the world also adapt so that mothers can quickly respond to a baby's cry, and that their brain responses are different from those of women who do not have children. Researchers from the National Institutes of Health watched the behavior of 684 mothers who had infants approximately 5 months old in North and South America, 3 countries in Western Europe, 2 in Sub-Saharan Africa, 1 in the Middle East, and 2 in East Asia. Mothers in all of those places were more likely than not to do the same thing when their infant cried in distress. They picked them up, held them, and talked to them. Sometimes, although less frequently, they showed affection, distracted them, and nurtured them. The researchers then monitored the brains of new mothers in the U.S. and more experienced mothers in China and Italy, and found that at both experience levels, these responses were deeply wired into the nervous system at a level that's typically associated with instincts. Parental caregiving blends tuition and intuition, write the authors in the study. Some aspects of parenting are learned, as through culture, but parents also rely on their instincts in caregiving. When the moms heard their babies making a fuss, the areas of the brain that were activated were those that are usually associated with the intention to move and speak, with the production of speech, and with auditory stimuli. In other words, the crying of babies triggered the mom's brains to move and prepare to talk, even before the mothers had necessarily processed what was happening and what they needed to do. We have done studies that show that within 100 milliseconds of the onset of an infant cry, women show a motor-evoked response associated with arm movement, says Dr. Mark Bornstein, head of Child and Family Research at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development and lead author of the study. Don't all humans have this response to crying babies? Not quite. The study found that when compared to women who did not have children, mothers exhibited more pronounced neural responses in brain areas involved in emotional processing in response to infant cries. The researchers surmised that mothers experienced the cry as an emotionally important signal to which they had to respond straight away. The similarity of response across different cultures and the fact that the brain changes were detectable within 3 months of giving birth suggest that this is a built-in system to protect the most vulnerable humans. Mothers can take some comfort that if they don't know exactly why their infants are crying, if they pick them up and talk to them, they're doing exactly what other moms across the world are doing too. James Comey just revealed his secret Twitter account, by Abigail Abrams. Former FBI Director James Comey put an end to months of speculation when he revealed his secret Twitter account on Monday. "Goodbye, Iowa. On the road home. Gotta get back to writing," he wrote in a tweet that featured a photo of him standing on an empty road. "We'll try to tweet in useful ways." After the tweet, Benjamin Witz, the editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a friend of the former FBI director, confirmed the Twitter account does indeed belong to Comey. "Okay, in light of this latest tweet, I will confirm that @former_BU is in fact James Comey himself." Comey has mostly stayed out of the public eye since President Donald Trump fired him in May amid an investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. He emerged to testify before Congress about the investigation, but has otherwise kept a low profile. But the former FBI director has sent other tweets from this account, which now uses the handle @former_BU and the name Reinhold Niebuhr. In March, Gizmodo reported that Comey was using Twitter under the handle @ProjectTextile7. His recent tweets include photos of West Point, Gettysburg, and Iowa, where he wrote that he was thinking about Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer, which asks God to grant serenity for things one cannot change. Comey is also writing a book about leadership and yet unheard anecdotes from his career, set to come out in the spring of 2018.
The internet is loving that George W. Bush made Barack Obama laugh during Bill Clinton's speech, by Megan McCluskey. The internet is all about the moment George W. Bush cracked Barack Obama up. During Bill Clinton's speech at a hurricane relief concert attended by all five living former U.S. presidents. While Clinton spoke at Saturday night's Deep from the Heart, the One America Appeal event at the Reed Arena at Texas A&M University in College Station to raise money for victims of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, the younger Bush leaned over to Obama and whispered something that made his presidential successor let loose a laugh. The giggly scene quickly began to make the online rounds, with some who watched the clip tweeting about how much they enjoyed watching the former commanders-in-chief bond. Bush pulling a dad move, cracking a joke to Obama during Clinton's speech, and glancing repeatedly to see his reaction. User Classic Dad Move wrote, "W cracking a joke to Obama while Clinton gives a speech is me in middle school." User Justin Taylor added.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.